If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On today's podcast, we've got an interview with Helen Birkett about the spread of medieval news. Helen is senior lecturer in medieval history at the University of Exeter, with a particular research interest in communications and how information, in particular news, was transmitted in the Middle Ages. Our content director, David Musgrove, met up with her in Exeter to find out more.
First question, I suppose, is we think of news and we think of prints and we think of Caxton printing press, and that's, you know, that's where news comes from. I guess that's what we tend to think. So that's obviously later than the period that we're talking about. Why are we talking about news in the medieval period? But how does that even affect?
Well, I love your skepticism, because this is actually a problem. So there's two things that are really important to consider when thinking about news in the Middle Ages, and they're to do with, first of all, we don't know that much about news in the Middle Ages or before the advent of print. And that's an interesting historical problem in itself. So that's something I want to explore just for my own intellectual satisfaction. But it also causes problems for the general history of news. So the history of news, as you said, is really tied to the history of print and printed media. So the history of news tends to be the history of newspapers, although now that we have broadcast news, things are broadening out a bit more in the modern period. Now, this focus on news and its relationship to modern news and modernity and what makes the modern period distinctive means that we get this history of news intertwined with bigger assumptions about the modern world. So news is seen to be crucial in the modern world because it's a really foundational part of modern political culture. So discussions about news and the circulation of news helps alert voters to what they should vote for. It helps us hold those in power to account. We've also seen that kind of idea of progress towards modernity through the history of news and its relationship to communications. So news progresses with the great leaps in communication with print, then with telecommunications, and now with that digital world that's giving us access to news all over the planet at the exact moment it's happening.
Sure.
And also allied with that, we have news becoming part of this discussion of the history of the experience of time. So news is seen as part of this heightened sense of the present that is distinctively modern. So all this kind of history of news is tied up with this idea of the modern world. And for the early modernists, they've noticed this relationship and they position themselves as foundational in the history of news. Like you said, they say, look, newspapers emerge in our period and we have the growth of that modern commercial news market. And all this kind of narrative of the history of news is based on ideas of difference. So early modern and modern news is different to what went before.
Mm-hmm.
The medieval period is other, news and communication stuck in the Dark Ages. It's completely different to what happens. Now, that's a really nice narrative. It's really clear. It's really simple. But it's got a problem because we don't know that much about news in the Middle Ages. So even just knowing a bit more about what's happening has the potential to unsettle this kind of complacent discussion about modernity. For example, instead of looking at difference, what happens if we focus on continuities in communications between that medieval and early modern period? This is something that early modernists are actually doing. They've noticed that despite the advent of print and the growth of newspapers, scribal news, handwritten news, still plays a really important role. Now, that is an older technology. That is evidence of a continuity of practice. You know, you could look back at the medieval world and think, well, what was scribal news doing then? So if we start to emphasize these kind of histories of continuity, then maybe we start to pick up on a different understanding of what news is in the present. You know, we start to highlight what the real difference is, what the real changes are.
So wait a second, are you saying that even after the printing press, people were scribal news was still a big thing?
Yes, people are still writing newsletters and circulating them. And it's actually, the reasons for it are quite obvious in a sense. It's because printed news can be censored and handwritten news can't be. Mm. So the role of scribal news, I think, may still retain some real importance in totalitarian cultures because it's something that's not as easily monitored, not as easily censored.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Going back to the medieval period, though, you've had a look at it. What, in your view, sort of constitutes news in the Middle Ages?
Well, this is a really important thing in the way that I think we should reconceive this whole discussion about news. So the focus on modern news has kind of created a focus on genres of news. So if we look at historical news, for example, the 18th or 19th century, we think, okay, let's go to a newspaper. Let's go and look at that. If we want to look at news in the Middle Ages, well, it's before newspapers. So like, well, where is the news? We don't know what news is. So you have to think again, well, what is news in this period? And the definition that I'm working with is that news is the exchange of new time-sensitive information that alerts others to changes in their wider or immediate environment. So it's news as a social exchange. It's where people communicate and create bonds with each other, so individuals and groups, but they're also sharing norms about their society with this news, both positive and negative. So thinking about it as a social interaction opens up a wider perspective on news already. So it stops us being tied to genre. Now, this works particularly well for predominantly oral cultures like the Middle Ages, because most of the news there is spoken and heard. So you're having news circulating through social networks at all social levels. They're probably exclusive, so they're not interacting that much. But I think they're also probably quite effective.
So that presents a problem for you in researching medieval news, though, if you're saying it's all oral, but that's not going to...
It's not all oral. So most of it, I think, is oral. But when we think about it as a social exchange, well, when people are talking to each other about news in everyday life, occasionally we might have mentions of that in the sources, but we don't have those conversations recorded. However, if those people are trying to have that conversation at a distance, then they need to use a written medium to get in touch. They need to use letters. So letters are a really important source of news in the Middle Ages.
Okay, so that's good. That gives us an opportunity to jump into this particular episode that you've looked at, the exchange of letters, around about 1187.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to sketch out the story for us. But basically, we're talking about how the story of the Battle of Hattin in 1187 and then the fall of Jerusalem was communicated from the Middle East into Western Europe, into Christendom. So can you just sort of sketch out what's happening there so we can be clear about it?
So we have the Battle of Hattin on the 4th of July, and this is where Saladin and his army defeat the main Christian forces in the Holy Land. And this is it's a real disaster for the Christians in the East. We have the capture of the King of Jerusalem, and also the capture of the relic of the true cross. So there's a kind of double whammy there where they lose the ruler and they also lose their talisman over there. Now, the defeat at Hattin really decimates Christian forces in the East, and it leaves the Holy Land vulnerable to Saladin's forces, who then march through and city after city fall in the autumn of 1187. And this culminates in the Siege of Jerusalem, which starts in late September, and within just 2 weeks, Jerusalem falls on the 2nd of October to Saladin.
So this is bad news for the Crusader states. This is pretty serious stuff.
Well, it's bad news for the Crusader states, but it's a real heart-stopping moment for people in Europe as well, Western Europe. So Jerusalem is at the centre of their mental world. After the capture of Jerusalem in the First Crusade, it seemed as preordained that Christians should have Jerusalem. And to lose it, it really upsets them. It makes them wonder what's going on. Why is God so angry with us, is the question they're asking.
And the response in Western Christendom is the Third Crusade.
Yes.
Which happens, when does that happen?
Well, the launch of the Third Crusade happens at the end of October. And it's one of the quickest responses to horrific news from the East that we get from the papacy. It's a real immediate response to terrible news, and also one which is unusually emotional. The response of the papacy, the papal encyclical, Audita Tremendi, is a really emotional document. You get a real sense of the shock and horror that is there at the Curia, the papal Curia, when this news breaks.
Okay, so we've got a really constrained time period here, haven't we? Because we've got the fall of Jerusalem, was that 2nd of October, is that right?
Yes.
And then we've got the announcement of the Third Crusade, are we saying 29th of October, is that right? Something like that?
Yes.
Yeah, 1187, so the same year. So that's only, that's in a month. So if you...
It's in a month, but actually those two things aren't directly related.
No. But if in the modern news environment, you would think, well, okay, well, that's clearly, those two things must be linked. And so that's, you know, you would chart the progress.
Well, this is also the impression we get from the Chronicles and Histories documenting this.
Okay.
So our sources for events in the Middle Ages are mostly Chronicles and Histories, and they take this kind of global perspective on events. So they record events as they happened, not when they hear about them. You know, that would make for a very an overly messy way of representing the past. So they're simplifying it, they're organizing it.
Yeah.
When I've been looking at the evidence, the launch of the Third Crusade is clearly in response to news of the Battle of Hattin and some of those other major cities falling. I think they know about the threat posed to Jerusalem in autumn 1187. But when the Third Crusade is launched, they think it's going to hold out for a much longer time period than it does.
Okay. So any link between the actual fall and the actual announcement is of the Third Crusade, that's just too tight, because how long are we thinking it takes to get news from the Middle East, the Holy Land, to Western Europe?
The answer is it varies.
Mm.
And this is one of the really interesting things about the case study. So at its optimum, that news possibly could have got there in that time.
Really?
So if everything had been fine, if all communications networks had been functioning as normal, as expected, it might well have made it. But you have several things to consider. The first of those is the variability of the sea crossing across the Mediterranean. Now, it's quite seasonal, and it's also dependent on the sea conditions at that particular time. There are better times to cross the Mediterranean in the years, and those times are spring and autumn.
Because of the prevailing winds.
Because of the wind. Yeah. Yeah. So until you're able to navigate you're able to sail not being reliant on the winds, that remains an issue, you know, into the early modern world. So we have the variability of the sea crossing. This is quite interesting when we think about how news of Hattin comes across in between late summer and early autumn. We have in the set of letters that remain alerting the West to what's gone on, and these letters they contain news, but also they're the people in the East desperate for aid. They're saying, this is what's happened, come and give us support. So it's not just simple news letters. Anyway, so we have these letters being sent. The earliest one seems to be about late July, early August. And
where's it sent from?
Well, in the East, it's one of those ones where we don't quite know who's sending it, but we do know that it's circulating in Germany in late November.
Okay.
Now, it's quite an early letter that's sent, but our evidence for when news of Hattin actually reaches the papal curia in Ferrara, well, I think that's about early to mid-October. Now, I think what happens is we have several different letters being sent between this period, in this kind of early, late summer, early autumn period. So there's this really early letter, and then there's some later letters that are sent, you know, around about September. And they're still talking about Hattin because that is, you know, that is recognized as the major event that has caused the advance of Muslim forces through the East. But it also documents the other cities that are falling. So you get this kind of rolling news coverage in a sense when you look at these letters. But I think these letters, even though they're written at quite different times, they arrive in the Curia at about the same point.
Okay.
And that variability in how long it's taken these letters to come over to the West, so between 1 and 3 months to reach the Curia, that's about those communications in the East and the variability of that sea crossing.
And the sea crossing is presumably the best way to do it. Whatever the maritime conditions, it's going to be quicker than trying to travel over land.
Probably.
Okay. We talked about that first letter, and you said you're not quite sure who wrote it or where it's from. You've identified some 20 letters or something like that that are talking about these events. We must know who some of them are written.
Oh
by.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So who's writing them, and then how are they actually being taken back? Is the person who's written them taking them back, or is there some system of porterage in some way?
Yeah, so we have about 13 letters that I think are sent from the East in this period that cover Hattin, various cities falling, and including the fall of Jerusalem. So over a longer time period. And they're sent by, I don't know, we might call them stakeholders or interested parties in the Holy Land. So we have the rulers in the Holy Land, so Prince Bohemond of Antioch. We have important letters sent by the monastic military orders, or, you know, the semi-monastic military orders. Mm. So we're talking about the Templars and the Knights Hospitallers. We also have, in addition to letters, we have envoys coming over. So Archbishop Josias of Tyre comes over himself. And later narratives, the old French narratives about this period, they say that he travels over in this boat with a black sail, so that people know he's bringing terrible news. He comes over to Europe.
Do you think that's true, by the way? It seems like quite a... How would you happen to have some black sails lying around? Is that...
I really don't know if it's true or not. It's an unusual detail to include for that story. And one of the really interesting things about this emphasis on Archbishop Josias is that when I've looked at the other evidence, it bears out that later story that he's playing this important role in bringing the news to the West.
Mm.
But it may have some kind of classical associations that they're playing with.
Yeah.
Then we have Archbishop Josias himself going around spreading news. So I think he's probably also carrying some other letters from Tyre. I can't be sure, but that's my suspicion. But he's also there passing on this written, documented letter about events. But he's supplying extra information. He's trying to persuade people to come to the aid of those in the Holy Land.
Was he coming back on an actual mission to do that, to beg for help, or was he coming back with some other alternative motive?
Oh, no.
That was it.
To think that he has a different motive will be a misunderstanding of the situation. This is a disaster. This is his main reason for coming to Europe, to promote military intervention.
Okay. So it would be in his interest, or in the interest of his mission, to make the news sound as bad and as bleak as possible, presumably.
Yes, it would be. But the news is bad and the news is bleak. So it's not a stretch for him.
Yeah. No, I'm just wondering about how far we can tell sort of the factual accuracy of the news that's being transmitted by these people. Like, you know, obviously everyone's got a motive. Everyone's got a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to write a newsletter, there has to be a reason why you would do that. Nobody's going to be paying you. There's no concept of a paid journalist at this period, is there? So if you're writing news to somebody, there is a reason why you're doing it. And so it's your job, I guess, as the historian, to try and understand what that motive is and to make sure that you can be clear about what they're trying to say and how that links to the historical veracity of their story.
Yeah, no, that is an important point. They're not always shy about their motives, though. Mm-hmm. So this idea that the news is impartial, well, that's not really the case. They're always putting a spin on it. But because of the way that we tend to have news being contained in sections of letters that discuss other matters or make demands based on news, the motivations for writing those letters are normally quite transparent.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Were people in the Middle Ages very, very different? Were they substantially different? Have we evolved since then? Or do they have the same cognitive functions? Are they still Homo sapiens as we are?
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Okay, so we've got letters moving from high-powered people in the Middle East to high-powered people in the West. Mm-hmm. And then things happen as a consequence of that. So the Third Crusade is launched as a consequence of the news of the Battle of Bertie.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that I think makes this example so useful and so interesting, is that we have the initial burst of news of what's going on in the East is kind of contained in elite circles. So these are letters between elite groups or groups that are interested in potentially the economic activities in the Holy Land. So we have Genoese merchants bringing this news back. We have the military orders, who are based in the West but active in the Holy Land. So obviously, they're part of that that group that's particularly interested in it. Then when it gets to the papal curia, the news story changes. It gets new features. So Gregory VIII issues Audita Tremendi, which is a call to crusade. And it's a call to crusade for all Christians. It's saying something terrible has happened. We need to respond. So he wants a military response, but he also imposes a penitential fast on the Christians in Western Europe. You know, this is to say, think about what you've done. Think about how we can appease God and change the situation. And all Christians are expected to undertake this fast. So we get a real, well, tangible shift in a new story that might have been contained to the elites if it was just about international politics. But this is now something that has to go right through society. And that comes from the papacy. So it spreads out through the church's network. So it spreads out to bishops who then take it down through their own networks in their diocese, down to parish level. Now, also as part of that, you have this call for crusade. Our rulers, our elites are meant to go on crusade and they need resources and manpower. So again, we're having international elite politics having an effect that is more than just the elite. So this call for resources and manpower is probably most evident in England and France, where, well, particularly England, where they levy a Saladin tithe. So a tithe is levied by the king in order to pay for a crusading army. And for that tithe to be effective, well, possibly he can strong-arm money out of people, but actually there's also a case where he can persuade them with this news that this is why you need to contribute. So we have people at the lowest level of society knowing about events in the Holy Land.
So this is where it gets really interesting for me, because I get the idea about these high-level communication networks and things happening as a result of that. And that's, you know, that feels like a reasonable thing, and you can understand that. But when it comes to saying, right, there's a peasant walking down the road in Melton Mowbray, and he says, you know, he says to his friend Bob, "Have you heard the news about the Crusades?" That just feels like an unlikely scenario in the Middle Ages to me, because my no doubt incorrect view is that, you know, people's lives are so constrained in their village, and, you know, and they hardly ever leave the village, and, you know, they're all about the agriculture, and the news that they would be talking about would be the West Meadows flooded. That's the news. But to think about people saying, having an interest in international politics at the time just seems anomalous to me. So put me right.
Well, one of the things about news is that it has to be relevant to the audience. Otherwise, it's just new information that they're not particularly engaging with. So when you have news, you're always assuming that the audience is interested in it. And we have different types of news circulating. We have family news, we have personal news, etc. Now, because of our interest in modern news genres, we tend to just focus on hard news and high political news. Well, we have all these different types of news circulating in the Middle Ages, and people will be interested in news that impacts on them or is relevant to them.
Yeah.
And there are points at which high elite international events will have an impact on that peasant Bob.
Yeah.
And I think we should imagine that they will know about them if it's going to have a tangible effect on their lives. And we also shouldn't limit them by saying that, well, actually, of course, they're not interested in these other areas. When you think about the centrality of Jerusalem and the Holy Land to them as Christians and part of a wider Christian community, this is news that is going to affect them.
So do you think, let's just try and delve into that a bit more. Do you think from what you've looked at that the average man in the street would have had, what sort of geopolitical knowledge would they have had? I mean, it's almost impossible to tell, isn't it? But you, what you're saying is they must have had something. And certainly if they were going to pay the Saladin tithe, then they, you know, they would have been encouraged to learn about it because that would have given them an incentive to pay.
So this is one of these really interesting questions about medieval news. And I'm going to talk about Archbishop Baldwin of Canterbury's preaching tour in Wales.
Excellent.
In Lent 1188. So he undertakes this preaching tour to convince the Welsh to join the Crusade army. And we know a lot about this tour because Gerald of Wales wrote a whole book about it. And what's really interesting there is that we have the Archbishop meeting with Southern Princes of Wales at the start of his tour in New Radnor. And then he goes on, he makes his progress through Wales, and he arrives in places and encounters crowds.
Okay.
So I think we have to imagine that those crowds have been gathered there for a purpose, and that they probably know what that purpose is. They know they're there to hear some crusade preaching. This becomes even clearer, I think, when we have the example put forward by Gerald of Wales, when he's explaining, as he often does, what a great person he is, how talented he is, how his rhetorical capabilities are, you know, supreme. And he says, well, you know, I preach to the Welsh around me in languages they didn't understand. So there's preaching going on in Latin and French, yet still they came up and took the cross, and they had tears, you know, coming from their eyes, weeping, etc. Now, if we think about that, if they're there, if they're responding to this, but they don't know the language, then, well, there might be translators present around them. But the more obvious idea is that they know why they're there. They already know this news. So I want to get away from this idea that people in the Middle Ages are just randomly milling around towns and convening without an idea that there might be news, and they're suddenly presented with news, and this is very exciting for them. I actually want to think about this as a much more dynamic news environment, where they probably know a lot more and they have much wider interests than we might think.
So that requires a network, you know, communication networks going on, which would presumably be oral, as you mm-hmm. alluded to earlier, to A, get them into the right place at the right time,
and
B, then to be interested enough to actually go.
There's a really nice example that got me thinking in great depth about this topic, which is slightly earlier. And it's about the communication of the election of the Pope in Jerusalem in the 1160s. And it's during a schism. And we have people being convened to hear this news. And what's really interesting is that we know they're being convened, and we know that they know what they're going to hear, because it's also recorded that they send their apologies to the Pope and congratulate him on his election.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense at which people might actually gather to hear more about news, you know, so they have the headlines and they want to engage with it further. And I think that's perhaps how we should understand some of the preaching of the crusade, some of these crowds gathering, is that they have a sense of what they're already there for, that they may well know the main story, but they want to know about it more. And in a sense, just as we might post things on Twitter and hope to get some kind of crowd reaction to help reinforce that we're thinking about things in the right way, or that other people share our understanding and response, I think we have that kind of communal nature of news.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll come back to social media in a second if we can, but I'm thinking, this is really interesting in terms of the concept of place and time, I think, because we've got these news stories are traveling over quite a long period. So, you know, things happening in July and then you're hearing about them several months later. What does that make us feel about how medieval people would have understood about time and about the distances involved and their reaction to it? You know, would they have grasped the fact that something's happened quite a long way away, quite a long time ago, and that their reaction to that, even if it is immediate, is not going to, you know, things will have moved on where that story happened. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Well, news isn't when the event happens, it's when you hear about it.
Yeah.
So it's news to you at that point. And I think one of the things that makes people engage with news that happened possibly far away and possibly within a few months, maybe even longer, is that they have that emotional or intellectual response to it. So there's a kind of, it stops them in their tracks slightly, and they're kind of in the sensation of that moment of, wow, this is new and exciting, or this is tragic, or, oh, I didn't expect that. So that sense of news, that sense of the moment is for them,
yeah,
not in relation to that event. And the kind of other aspect of your question, well, they wanted to hear the news as soon as possible, and they had understood the limitations of contemporary communications. So they wouldn't expect to hear things instantaneously.
No.
but they would expect to hear it as soon as might be feasible for the state of the communications networks, for how long it might take to get from particular places.
And in terms of their reaction to it, so the Pope issuing the Third Crusade as a consequence of hearing about the Battle of Hattin, do you think he would have thought to himself, well, anything could have happened in the intervening period between the battle and me hearing the news? So the response that he gives, is that, is there any way to understand that? Yeah.
Well, this kind of brings us back to another point about the dissemination of news of Hattin and Jerusalem that I talked about in this article. And one of the unexpected things from this case study was that the evidence indicated that news of the fall of Jerusalem is delayed. I don't think it arrives in the West until probably March 1188. Now, previously, we thought it arrived in November, so we thought it moved very quickly. But I think because of the dislocation in the Holy Land means that those communications, those normal communications networks have been taken out. There's also, you might think, well, surely the refugees from Jerusalem. So we have various refugees moving out of Jerusalem after it falls. Actually, they're controlled quite carefully. They're taken under armed guard to the borders of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. We do have some who are taken to Alexandria, where actually they seem to be interned until March 1188. So even people who know about it, their movement isn't quite as free. And then plus you have, because of the seasonal nature of maritime travel, we have a lot of ships being laid up for the winter because, you know, the seas get rough. There's not actually a great deal of point in putting them out there. So there are fewer vessels available to take news across. Now, one of the questions I have been asked is, you know, what is the impact of this delay about not hearing about Jerusalem? And, well, our interpretation of what might have happened has changed rather than the actual events. But I do wonder if that extended delay, the difference is an emotional one. So we have this news of Hattin in mid-October and what's happened, and we have an understanding that there is a threat posed to Jerusalem and that Jerusalem's fate is hanging in the balance. And possibly that really spurs on an urgency in terms of preparations for the crusade and the transmission of this news. And it may be that when this news comes through that actually Jerusalem's fallen, that that sense of urgency ebbs away a bit. And we might factor that into the delay in the actual military response to what happens in the East. So we don't have the big expeditions, the big crusade expeditions setting out until 1189.
Okay. That's really interesting. But you've mentioned a couple of times there sort of the emotional reaction to news. And that just puts me in the mind of our modern reaction to news. And there's a couple of things there. A, we're often told we shouldn't look at the news too much because, you know, we can't do anything about it. And it's just, you know, people get addicted to the news and, you know, constantly on Twitter trying to find out what's happening. And actually, if you waited a bit, then you would find out and it would be clear and that sort of thing. And then the other side of the coin is that we hear about news, we hear about terrible things happening, and there's nothing we can do about it. And it just makes us feel guilty and stressed and you know, sad and it isn't good for us either. Is there any sense that either of those two things are sort of in play in the Middle Ages? Are people hearing news from places like, you know, like the fall of Jerusalem and tearing their hair out and thinking this is the worst thing in the world and feeling impotent about it?
Well, so you bring up the fall of Jerusalem there, and one of the weirdest things about this whole the transmission of news of the fall of Jerusalem is that it's a big cultural memory of what happens in 1187. But actually finding out when this news comes to Europe was really difficult because I don't have that moment where they say, oh no, Jerusalem's fallen. I have people remembering that there might have been a moment like that, but they didn't tell me when it happened. So in terms of this feeling of impotence at events being very far away, well, that's mitigated a bit in this instance because the Pope says there are things you can do. And one of them is, you know, going on this fast that you should be doing, thinking about your own soul and the nature of your own sin, and also supporting this crusade. So there is a way in which they can respond actively to this news. But it is something that impacts on medieval people, and it does seem to shock them and upset them and make them angry, because they wonder what exactly has happened out in the Crusader states. Is it their fault?
Mm-hmm. Okay. But these are hard things to understand, I guess. These are hard things to get into.
Well, so one of the big questions about medieval news, which is really tough, is reception. So people responding to news. Now, it's actually not that easy in the modern world either to understand exactly how people are receiving news and getting a real feel for what people do with news stories, how they interpret them. And it gets even harder when you get to the Middle Ages, when a lot of that discussion is oral and isn't recorded. We can get a sense of how people hear about news and when they hear about news, because we see their response, an active response. And we do have people discussing these events. So people are writing tracts to promote people joining the Crusades. We have kind of discussions of responses by chroniclers, so saying, oh, you know, everybody was weeping because it was terrible news. And those are the kind of indications we get. But that bigger question of reception and how people respond to news is a tough one. And one of the ways I think we have to think about it is when people spread news, they assume it's going to be of interest and relevant to its recipients. Now, they may be wrong in that. And in the modern world, we have examples of that where newspaper stories are spun an entirely wrong way and get a poor response. Yeah. But it's hard for us to measure that in the Middle Ages. So we have to interpret the expected response as the probable response of the audience. Now, there are limits to that, but I still think looking at news in the Middle Ages, despite these differences in evidence and the difference in availability of evidence, is still a really useful thing to do, because what my case study did was flagged up how knowing more about the information that is available at the time will help us understand the actions of decision makers. It puts us much more effectively in their shoes.
Okay. Just a couple more things. I said we should talk about social media quickly. I was just thinking, if I've done something good, if I've run a marathon or something, then I want to post it on Facebook so all my friends know about it and, you know, can applaud me and say how brilliant. Is there any element that transmission of news in the Middle Ages was developed by that sort of thing? But, you know, I imagine if I was a big lord and I'd won a big battle, I'd want everyone to know about it. So how would I transmit that information, that social media kind of news, so that everyone knows that I'm the big guy and I've done the good thing?
Well, you could talk about it.
Yeah.
It'll operate differently on different levels. So you could just tell your friends. You might be subject to comments about a lack of humility, but that's one way of spreading that information. Or if it's an elite or state power, you might have that proclaimed throughout your kingdom. You might have it proclaimed by, in England, possibly sheriffs. Later on, we have town criers. Or you might have it proclaimed from the pulpit. If you have won a victory in a battle, which isn't quite the same thing we spread on social media today, actually it's probably got some political implications. So there is a bigger political background to that kind of thing. Again, for example, good news about the birth of a new royal heir or a new heir to an estate. That's kind of a good news story, but it also has big implications in terms of, you know, have an heir who will inherit that. There won't be any problems of succession, etc. So perhaps sharing the kind of the good news stories, again, we might be looking at the bigger impact of those. It's not, if you want to share little tidbits about maybe, you know, you had a particularly good crop, it's probably something you'll do orally.
I suppose the last thing is going back to what you talked about to start with, and that this is an understudied area, and that sort of a lack of recognition that news in the Middle Ages is even a thing. imagine it was quite difficult for you to do carry out the research for this case study that you've done in terms of trying to find all these letters and locate the sources. Where does this go? What's the future for medieval news research? What do you want to see happen?
I'd like to see us look at news more closely and carefully. So I think looking into medieval news further, understanding how it's transmitted, how people respond to it, what it actually means to people in the Middle Ages, I think will just expand our knowledge base. And that's very important because it will help deepen the history of news. So one of the things that strikes me when I look at news in the Middle Ages is that there is a wider vocabulary for news. So in Latin, in my case study, they're using words like nuncium, rumour, farmer. If you look at Middle English terms, you have tithings, news, word, report, fame. So we have a much more varied vocabulary than just kind of the simple term news that we use today. And I wonder if that points to news being conceived in different, more interesting ways. So this bigger understanding of news and the kind of a more diverse context of news will help us think about news differently in the modern world and the early modern world. So I think there's a real value there. In terms of things that I want to do with this research further, well, looking at news raises all kinds of interesting questions, particularly when you have a look at what scholars of the early modern and modern world have said about it. So when I've been reading these works, I've been struck by how strange their idea of the Middle Ages is at certain points. And one of these discussions that I'm going to follow up at the moment is a discussion about, well, what is the difference between news and history? And this plays into a bigger discussion about news and its relationship to the experience of time and the present. And because of the way that our news sources from the Middle Ages are preserved, so we tend to have these letters preserved in chronicles and histories where they provide these ready-made narratives of events that have happened. There's been a kind of an assumption from scholars of later periods to say, oh, okay, so they're putting news in a chronicle. Our chronicle, that seems to be the newspaper equivalent. And here they think, well, yeah, we have chronicle used as a newspaper title. So they're seeing a continuity there. But actually, they're completely right when they say, look, medieval people putting news in chronicles, they're seeing it as a historical thing, as something that's happened and it's gone, it's in the past. They don't really have a proper sense of the present because they don't have a proper news media. And this is part of this bigger argument of, well, they saw it as something that was in the past and that occurred long ago, whereas now in the modern world, we're part of this present news, ever-changing environment. And that's a misreading of the evidence. Modern and early modern historians are right. That recording of news in chronicles is a historical process. It's about an archive. So the easiest way to think about it, I think, is taking a cutting from a newspaper and putting it in a scrapbook as a kind of historical collection. Mm. The understanding of this kind of division between news and history is present in the Middle Ages. It's just that that discussion about news as a present thing is probably happening orally. And some of those newsletters are ephemeral and they're being thrown away once they've served their purpose. But even just asking that question of when does news become history is a really important one for us to play around with, because it reveals more about our sources and more about how news is functioning. And it takes us back to a bigger approach to history, which characterizes how you will see the modern versus the medieval world, which is, were people in the Middle Ages very, very different? Were they substantially different? Have we evolved since then? Or do they have the same cognitive functions? Are they still Homo sapiens as we are? Now, if you think the former, if you think we're very, very different, it's easier for you to say they experience time and news in a very different way. If you think they're very much similar to us, but living in a different technological environment, have different cultural expectations, values, but still have that same cognitive function, well, the news will operate in a very similar way. It's just that the way it's recorded and how they choose to, I don't know, keep it or respond to it might be different. But it's one of the things I really like about this project is that it's throwing up some really important bigger questions. So when is the current, the kind of the stopping point between news, current events and history? What does that experience of the present mean in a much earlier context? And can we use news to explore that? I think yes, but you know, other people might disagree with me based on how they think about humans and change.
If you enjoyed this discussion and want to hear more from Helen on this subject, she recently wrote an academic article about news in the Middle Ages for the journal Viator. There's also a whole load more material on medieval life on our website at historyextra.com/medieval. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Friday when James Shapiro will be discussing his new book, Shakespeare in a Divided America.